Good morning, John. Karen Larson on behalf of Mr. McDaniels, who is sitting at the bench with me today. It is our position that the court erred by not allowing Mr. McDaniels to argue the case that he wanted to argue, and that was to present evidence of the spent catalyst concerns at the mobile plant in Long Beach or in Torrance that was creating so many problems, and by eliminating to his entire witness list and eliminating the evidence to address safety concerns, Mr. McDaniels was not able to present the case that he wanted to. And that was basically one for retaliation for disclosing and discussing spent catalyst policies and insisting that they accommodate him in a situation. He wanted to return to the area where he had been working in the utilities, and that he could not do so if they did not clear up the problem concerning the spent catalyst dust.
I noticed that the district judge, with just a simple one word, resolves the question as to whether or not there's collateral estoppel arising out of the state court proceeding. Did you ask the district judge to give you an explanation?
Your Honor, I didn't see that in the record. I wasn't the trial attorney. If I remember, I asked the associate. I don't know that if there was a hearing on the motion, and perhaps Ms. Doty can explain that. I don't remember.
In terms of what I see, I've got no explanation as to why the district judge did what he did on
that. That was my same question, Your Honor. I couldn't understand that as to how he found collateral estoppel applying. But even on that issue, I think I fully briefed, and the court and the panel is obviously much more familiar with the concept of collateral estoppel. Even though we have argued that it didn't apply, even if it did apply in the very narrow aspect, certainly the issue of whether the mobile employers and supervisors were aware of the safety problems and were concerned about re-raising issues in 1997, certainly whether that motivated them was an issue that was relevant that wouldn't even have implicated collateral estoppel. Certainly it was an overlap. Even if you wanted to argue that the state court had made a finding, which it did not, that there was safety, that a mobile didn't violate these statutes.
Well, the only thing that the state court might have decided, and it would be helpful to me if you could be really specific, is that there wasn't, as to something or other, at least as to whatever caused his injury, the exceptions to the workers' comp preemption didn't apply, and I guess the two pertinent ones would be an intentional act and a fraudulent
concealment.
So is there any way in which those two concepts would, you know, swallow up all the evidence that you wanted to put on?
Not at all. I mean that's basically our position. And I mean, that's what I argued, being an outsider looking at it, because I wasn't the trial, and it just kind of confused me how collateral estoppel could apply, because it seems like such a different issue.
There might be some things it did apply to. I mean, you're sort of saying that if we were to remand and say, well, this was wrong, there still might be some narrow area of collateral estoppel.
I'm only arguing that it didn't even make sense to me there, that even if the judge wanted to quickly this is a very
What's the answer to that question?
To the question for you, the answer to that question, that very specific question, I can't see in any how collateral estoppel will apply. I mean, the court very specifically, the state court said, this case cannot proceed because it's barred by the workers.
And no exceptions apply.
No, and also on the primary jurisdiction issue. Ms. Doty had very specifically argued on the unfair business practice and the safety violations that on the spent catalyst issue, that was not for the state court to even consider evidence on as to whether there were violations there, because the different environmental agencies had primary jurisdiction. So therefore, the state court didn't even address that issue, and there's nothing on the record that would suggest that it did. You only have the motion for summary judgment in the state court, and you only have the order. And nothing on the order would suggest that the court even considered whether mobile had spent catalyst policies was a violation. The only point that I was trying to make, that even if you wanted to argue that there was somehow some collateral estoppel because there was some evidence that Mr. McDaniel has complained about those policies, so what? The employers at that time thought that it was very dangerous for employees, including Mr. Graham, the union steward, to be talking about Catalyst. There was a policy to limit. Mr. Graham had been disciplined for circulating emails talking about spent Catalyst policies. The employers could not have known that a state court down the road was going to find them guilty or not liable. So the issue of whether it was on their mind, Mr. McDaniels and Mr. Graham and Mr. Jacobson all talking about this, certainly was a motivating factor.
Did you ever make a offer of proof as to what you would have put on? What is it that you wanted to put on and weren't allowed to put on, you know, with some precision?
What happened is what we wanted to put on was in all the opposition to the motion for summary judgment in the federal court. So that when the motion in limine was filed that repeated the motion for summary judgment, Mr. McDaniel's attorneys repeated their argument that collateral estoppel was not applicable and what evidence and how it was different. And what was argued in the opposition to the motion in limine was that the reason why it was more of a technical argument, but certainly the declarations that were filed in my supplemental excerpts and also in Ms. Doty's supplemental excerpts show what was going to be. And I refer.
So if we look at the opposition to the motion for summary judgment, we'll know what it is you want to put on.
Right, exactly, and as well as the opposition to the motion in limine. But very specifically, Mr. Jacobson's, in fact, and I know there was a problem because I was asking the court, and forgive me, to just look at the entire file coming up as opposed to including it. So when I did my brief, I hadn't filed the supplemental excerpts, and I simply referred to the clerk's docket. But in the supplemental excerpts of record volume 1 and 2, particularly volume 2 for whatever reasons it's in volume 2, you have Donnie McDaniel's declaration with all the exhibits, including the Mobil's policies saying that when there's spent catalyst in the FCC department, they had to wear spacesuits, almost like, I don't know if you ever watched the show Monk on TV, where he doesn't want to touch dirt or germs or anything, so he wears his suit. But in Mr. McDaniel's place, they didn't wear these outfits because there wasn't supposed to be spent catalyst in the area. Okay? So that all of the exhibits to the declarations were very, very important. Mobil, in their excerpts of record, did not include the all of the exhibits. For example, Mr. Jacobson talks about the letter he sent to the management talking about the history of the spent catalyst and why there was such problems with it and why it was dangerous.
I have two questions. First of all, is this... So you're centering on the spent catalyst issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. One of the things that Mobil says, as I understand it, is that isn't what he was complaining about at the time that he was discharged. So as far as you can make any inference from the timing and so on that of a retaliation, that that the whole spent catalyst issue isn't pertinent.
Well, it was relevant because Mr. McDaniel's whole position was that he couldn't work in the refinery unless he was walking around wearing a respirator mask that wasn't properly outfitted for him.
In terms of what he was threatening to tell Cal OSHA or wasn't threatening to tell Cal OSHA. And also, they also claimed they didn't know what he was threatening, that he was threatening to tell Cal OSHA anything at that point.
He went in with Mr. Graham in one of the meetings with Mr. Price specifically to talk about all the safety violations.
But was he threatening to complain to some other authority at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's what the record shows, the OSHA violations.
All right. And the other question.
I have to refer to Mr. McDaniels. I apologize.
Now, if this is a problem, is it a problem with respect to both causes of action or only with regard to the retaliation cause of action? In other words, how would all of this be pertinent to the disability claim?
Well, it's pertinent to the disability claim, and this is how I see it. I always thought the disability claim was the weaker claim. I mean, you can see it in my brief. To me, it was the wrongful termination. One, because juries don't like disability.
He did get workers' comp, didn't he?
I think he did get workers' comp. Okay.
He got workers' comp.
Yes.
Is he still getting workers' comp?
No.
working now?
Not in the refinery business, no, Your Honor.
What kind of work is he doing now?
I think he's trying to do some things where he's sponsoring creative artists in the music industry and things of that nature, Your Honor. And he's also running, I believe, a nursing home with his in-laws.
So,
but to go back to your question, Your Honor.
So, therefore, you're essentially saying there really isn't any connection to the disability claim, which is let that one alone?
Well, here's the connection. The connection is that at trial, there was a big deal made about Dr. Weintraub saying at the time that he shouldn't be in any area in which a respirator would have to be required. And so on cross-examination, when Mr. Lear wasn't allowed to question the supervisors such as about this whole issue, the spent catalyst, they were simply able to testify, well, I saw Donnie walking around with a respirator, and I knew he couldn't be in the utilities area wearing a respirator because his own doctor said it wasn't a problem. And therefore, we couldn't make an accommodation because in order to work in that area, you would have to wear a respirator. And they were arguing back and forth as to whether Dr. Weintraub was saying that was for all future or not. But the real point of the matter was, if Mobile cleaned up the spent catalyst, wasn't supposed to be coming out of that area. So if they cleaned up the problem, then he wouldn't have to wear a respirator in the area. And so wouldn't and none of the co-employees. And that's where the reasonable accommodation.
Well, now, you've also got on the disability discrimination claim, you've got a pretext question. That's to say, is there explanation of pretext? And if you can get in evidence that they canned him because of his report of safety violations and threat of reporting more, that's clearly relevant to your pretext argument.
Your Honor, you know my argument better than I do, and I apologize for looking a little disorganized up here, but that's exactly the whole point here is that juries have to hear evidence to conclude pretext, and they just didn't get it. All they got was Donnie McDaniel standing up there and being limited from talking about and nothing supportive of other people.
Yeah, the jury doesn't say, well, why else would they have done it? And the why else is your evidence you couldn't put in. I mean, that's your argument.
Yes, and it would have sounded, the Mobile employer sounded very reasonable because they were able to explain, well, he was walking around, we didn't want him wearing the respirator, and they sounded like good guys as opposed to there was this history of trying to hide, they didn't hear the information about other cancer, certain employees dying, nosebleeds, that if this had been an ongoing problem since 1997, that there was a limited amount of information being sent. These are all exhibits to the declarations, Your Honor.
Now, if we were to rule that the district judge was wrong with regard to collateral estoppel, that wouldn't preclude other evidentiary challenges, like just 403 sort of challenges, because at some point, presumably, the judge could limit how much of this stuff came in.
Oh, certainly. But you know, nothing came in. Even when the court reserved on the motion limiting number 3 to see if you could draw a connection as to notice, Mr. Lear wasn't even able, if you look at it, he keeps trying to ask questions about safety violations because the judge said, well, I'll let you talk about safety violations, and then if you can connect it, that they were aware of the safety violations and this resulted in the termination. But then Mr. Lear kept saying, but Your Honor, you're limiting from me from saying that. And at one point, the judge states, oh, that's right, I see. And he almost like he was able to see that he had made a mistake. But for whatever reason, Judge Hatter seemed to say, I want to move this case along. And by limiting, which I understand judges limiting. I mean, attorneys and witnesses can go on and on ad nauseum, but which I apparently am doing right here. But the 10 hours, and it was almost like a clock. And the judge would announce things like, you've got 7 hours left. And after eviscerating Mr. Lear's case like a week beforehand, that you're no longer going to argue what he thought he had preserved in the motion for summary judgment. And, of course, and this had nothing to do with it. It wasn't the judge's fault. Mr. Lear just had gotten the case 2 months earlier. I mean, of course, that's the way it is. But that he eviscerated, and then every time he tried to make an argument to tie things in, say, you've got 8 hours left, you've got 7 hours left, it was an impossible situation. And for whatever reason, the judge just didn't want to hear that case.
Get a permanent disability rating?
I don't think so.
So as far as the comp aspect is concerned, that comp considers them completely cured.
I guess, Your Honor. No, I'm not. I mean, and I apologize for that. That's true, but, I mean, sometimes it's interesting to know the equitable argument, and I should have known a little bit more about this. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases where I wasn't the trial attorney, and so, but I think the record is pretty clear, is it all? Any other questions? I'd just like to reserve some rebuttal time.
Okay. Take a break and have a cool glass of water.
How did you know that?
Good morning. I'm Martha Doty for the defendant and the appellee, Mobil Oil Corporation. It's our position in this, on this appeal, that this court should affirm the rulings of the district court below and the findings of the jury.
I found your brief somewhat mystifying. I mean, you list a whole bunch of things that you say the district court found. Where did you get those from? The only thing we know the district court found was that workers' comp claim was preemptive, and some undefined exceptions didn't apply. And you have a big list of facts that you say the district court found. Where are you getting that from?
Well, that was all the evidence that was submitted, both in opposition to the summary judgment motion and also on the motion in limine to preclude the evidence based on collateral estoppel in Rule 403.
But so what? You submit evidence to a district, to a state court, but if it doesn't decide anything having to do with the evidence because he decides that the cause of action is preempted, then how can you say he decided those things?
Oh, I'm sorry. You said the district court. Do you mean the
state court? You have a you list a set of facts that you say the state court found. And then you list a set of facts that you say were collaterally estopped. But the set of facts that you say the state court found, I don't see any evidence that they found them.
Well, I don't think that the state court, in granting the summary judgment, issued a list of the items that it found. But it did.
The ground that it went off on didn't require it to find those things.
Oh, I don't agree with that. Because the Mobil's summary judgment motion in the initial action, the toxic tort action, was on the basis that the exceptions to the workers' comp exclusivity rule did not apply, the exceptions being intentional injury and fraudulent concealment. And in order for Mobil to establish that it hadn't intentionally injured Mr. McDaniels or fraudulently concealed from him the circumstances of his injury, it had to put in all the evidence that established that it had complied with the law, that it had followed the proper procedures. And that was the evidence that it put in support of its motion for summary judgment.
It could have done it intentionally. It could have done it negligently.
But the issue in the state court action to determine whether workers' comp exclusivity exceptions apply required Mobil to show that it had not, that there were no disputed issues of fact as to whether it had intentionally injured Mr. McDaniels.
Okay, so everything it did negligently and not intentionally, that could still be the subject of a whole lot of complaints and things that were not collaterally estopped.
Well, let me address that, because the evidence in our case established that Mr. McDaniels didn't complain about those items during his employment.
That's a different issue.
It is. I agree. But
that's not what the district judge ruled on in the motion on limiting.
Well, it was part of our motion in limine. We had a 403 section of our motion in limine.
But that is what he ruled on.
It was part of the same motion. He didn't say whether he ruled on collateral estoppel or the 403 issue. He simply said that the motion was granted.
But you're arguing collateral estoppel here.
We also argued here on this appeal that the district court could just as well have granted our motion on the basis of Rule 403.
So you want us to decide the 403 motion now?
You can decide that. In fact, it's easier.
What if my view of the 403 motion is that every bit of it comes in? Do you still want me to decide it?
Well, we obviously think that the district court could have ruled on either ground and correctly ruled on the collateral estoppel grounds. But as an alternative, he could also have ruled on the 403 grounds.
Is subject to a great deal of discretion.
That's correct.
So. And we have no basis for thinking that he decided that in 403 grounds. So if we were to decide, we can't decide the 403 motion as on the de novo, right? The best we could do was decide it deferentially, and we have no basis for thinking he decided that.
Well, I don't know why you have any basis for thinking that he ruled on collateral estoppel more than he ruled on the 403 issue, because his order didn't identify whether he ruled based on.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the other side. Did you ask him to clarify?
No, we did not. He issued his order on the motions in limine, I believe on the Friday afternoon before we started trial. And we started trial on Monday and just
Yeah. Why look at just torch in the mouth? I mean, you won. Don't ask any more questions.
We were ready to go. You know, the other thing is that even before we, and I think this supports the argument that he could just as easily or readily have ruled on the 403 issues, because at a status conference, well before we had filed our collateral estoppel motion in limine, he issued the order on the time limitations.
Yeah, you know, 403 motions tend to be made and decided sort of piece of evidence by piece of evidence rather than a sort of huge big block.
You can't really decide a 403 motion until you understand what evidence is there and the context in which it's introduced and all that. Well, let me ask you that was there a workers' comp hearing?
There was a very lengthy workers' comp proceeding, yes.
Did any of this evidence that you're trying to keep out come in during that workers' comp hearing?
The evidence that came in during the workers' comp proceedings went to the extent of Mr. McDaniel's injuries to his lungs. I don't believe that it did. The record in the workers' comp case, as I recall, involved a deposition of Mr. McDaniels and a deposition of Mr. White as to the way that the accident occurred. The workers' comp proceeding had to do with the injury to his lungs and not with respect to how the accident had occurred. But I wanted to address...
I believe there is.
It was very difficult to get the workers' comp transcripts. I remember that. I believe there is. But I wanted to go back and address a point that you just made, which was that ordinarily a court doesn't rule on a block of evidence on a 403 motion and has to know. And I think your point was being made in response to my comment that the court had issued the time limits.
Well, I was a trial judge for many, many years, and that's the way I handled it.
Okay, but what I wanted to say is that... Well, it wasn't being handled in the abstract. It wasn't. When Judge Hatter issued his ruling that the trial was going to be limited to 20 hours, that was in December of 2003, I believe, following a mediation that we had. And it was after the court had denied our summary judgment motion. And we had filed all of our pretrial memorandum of points and contentions and facts of law. We had, in 03, we filed all of our trial documents. So when Judge Hatter limited the trial to 20 hours, 10 hours per site, he knew what evidence the plaintiff wanted to put in. He had 290 exhibits. He had 56 witnesses. So I think that you can just as readily decide that Judge Hatter limited the trial and limited the evidence that came in based on a 403.
There's no way you can do that. I mean, he may have felt that too many exhibits. They didn't need them all. And if he set certain hourly limits, they'd focus on their case. They'd trim it down. They'd put it in such a shape that it could move quickly and be easily understood. So you can't say anything.
Well, there was a comment that we cited in our brief that Judge Hatter made at that status conference.
In 10 hours, did he indicate that if you could show clear necessity, or one side could show clear necessity, that he would he'd consider adding some additional time?
I think he did. But I want...
You know who started that limit of hours? In the trial court, I did.
Well, thank you. It worked.
And he's in my old chamber.
There must have been karma. The point I wanted to make is that at that hearing where Judge Hatter limited the time, we quoted this in our brief. He said, we're not going to have any mini trials on other people's wrongful termination actions, and we're not going to be revisiting arguments and issues that have already been decided. Now, the latter comment suggests collateral estoppel.
The first one has nothing to do with what he's trying to put in. He's not trying to put in anything but other people's wrongful termination.
That's a 403. I think that's a 403 because what
it may be a 403, but it's not a relevant 403 because that isn't the evidence that he's now arguing about.
It is. It absolutely is because the person that he was saying had been, quote, unquote, wrongfully terminated was George Graham. He wanted to have George Graham come and testify that after he complained years earlier about spent catalyst, that he was put out in a very remote unit. Yeah, and that was what the Graham declaration said in opposition to our summary judgment motion.
And if that evidence is being excluded as not sufficiently probative, he might have made a mistake on that, too.
Well, I don't agree with that, because the question on the retaliation claim brought by Mr. McDaniels was, what did Don McDaniels complain about during his employment? He did not complain about Mr. Graham's demotion.
Did he complain about spent catalyst?
He did not.
Never.
And in
he
fact,
never had meetings about spent catalyst.
Never did. And in fact, what the evidence showed was that during his light duty period, he secretly collected spent catalyst in little dishes. And he never told anyone at Mobil that he was doing it. And then only after he filed his toxic tort action did he reveal that he had secretly collected the dust and had put it in his freezer and then had it tested independently at a lab. He didn't.
There's no evidence that he, during the, while he was employed, had anything, any visibility at all on the spent catalyst issue.
He did not complain about the spent catalyst issue.
But of course, none of this evidence was put in front of the district court.
Well, the district court, not before the jury, but Judge Hatter knew about it. Because what Mr. McDaniels complained about during his employment were actually only a couple things. One, he complained about his physical ailments. Two, he complained about whether the assignments that he was given during his light duty period complied with his doctor's restrictions. And three, he may have complained that we failed to get a witness statement from him. Those were his complaints.
Sounds to me as though you've got a pretty good argument for the jury when he puts in the evidence he was prevented from putting in the first time around.
I think we did. I think
you do. Not only did, but we'll have that opportunity.
Well,
and I speak only for myself at this point. But.
Well, we believe that the district court ruled properly.
What does fail to get a witness statement mean?
After an incident or an accident at the Torrance refinery, the procedure for the incident investigation was that the incident investigator would collect witness statements from anyone who was directly involved in the accident. And in Mr. McDaniel's case, the accident occurred on April 2nd. He was then gone from the refinery until till April 23rd. So, of course, the incident investigation takes place almost immediately after the accident occurred.
And this incident had nothing to do with spent catalyst or any of that?
It didn't. It had to do with the breaking of a pipe that vapors came through. It had nothing to do with spent catalyst. And what Mr. McDaniels was gone for 3 weeks, the period during which the incident investigator collected the witness statements. And so they couldn't get one from him. When he returned from work, he went to his supervisor and said, you know what, no one ever asked me for a witness statement. And Mr. Brooks said, you know what, why don't you present one? And he allowed Mr. McDaniels to go home and get his witness statement. And then Mr. McDaniels gave that witness statement to a completely different individual, Mr. Buckaloo or Mr. Clemenson, who were the incident investigators, neither of whom Mr. McDaniels had any evidence that they had anything to do with the employment decisions that were made in the case. So he complained that he hadn't been asked for a witness statement, but the evidence at trial showed not only that he was asked for one, but that he put one in and he gave it to someone who had nothing to do with the employment decisions. So that's something that I just want to emphasize, is that the evidence that Mr. McDaniel says he was denied from putting in is not evidence that supports any complaints that he made during his employment. These were theories that he developed in his toxic tort case that he filed in March of 2000 after he was already gone. He didn't complain about these things. He gathered all this evidence and filed it.
This whole discussion doesn't go to collateral estoppel, right?
No, it doesn't. It goes to really the substantive merits of a retaliation claim.
And it may go to a 403 claim, but
yes,
it will not a defense, which presumably you could re-raise when you go back, but it doesn't go to collateral estoppel.
Right, that's right. It's 403 because it shows how prejudicial that evidence is. Because if you don't complain about something and then you try to put in evidence to support a retaliation case that has nothing to do with any complaints you made.
Mentioned 403 when he made a ruling?
Well, he issued I know. He didn't. We didn't have oral argument, Your Honor. We didn't have oral. He issued the rulings by fax.
One other question. During the
trial, did he say 403 at any time?
He did not, and we referred to that motion in shorthand as the collateral estoppel
motion. So during the trial, when objections were raised, there was never any. Nobody ever said, "Oh, remember that collateral estoppel motion."
But that is exactly.
Nobody ever said it's precluded. During trial, it was referred to as a collateral estoppel determination.
It was.
Yeah. So it was. So therefore, that's the end of it, no?
Well, no, it's not, because that was just the shorthand. I mean, it was just our shorthand for it. I mean, I suppose I could have stood up and said, "Objection, Your Honor, that's barred by the collateral estoppel and 403 motion." But things were happening at a rapid pace, as you can imagine, under the time limit, so we just used the shorthand version.
The consequences are entirely different, and the determination at any particular objection might be different, depending on whether it was a collateral estoppel determination or a 403 determination.
Well, I don't agree with that, because I think
that... I've read parts of the transcript where these collateral estoppel objections are made. I have to say they sound like collateral estoppel objections. They do not sound like balancing 403 objections. It's just, boom, out. The judge says, yep, out.
Well, that may be. That may be. But, again, when those objections were raised, for instance, Ms. Larson argued that Mr. Lear was not able to go down lines of questioning.
You're kind of beating a dead horse.
Okay.
Try something else.
Well, our view is, and one of the reasons why we
put another way, well, the one thing you haven't stood up here and argued very much is that the collateral estoppel determination was correct. And if you have any way to tell us why it might have been, that might be helpful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I believe that the collateral estoppel determination meets all of the elements of the collateral estoppel rule. First, the issues were identical in the toxic tort case.
But they weren't, because they only the question isn't the issues. The question is what was decided, right?
Right. And what was decided was that workers' comp exclusivity applied because the exceptions that Mr. McDaniels had filed his claim under had not been established.
Because it wasn't
that
intentional, which is not relevant to the question of whether he complained about something that was going on in the plant. It could have been complained about something that wasn't intentional. And because there was no this fraudulent concealment thing, which is very narrow and basically says there has to be fraudulent concealment of that particular person's particular injury, and that has to have exacerbated his damages, and you know, and he could have decided that it didn't exacerbate the damages, and that would have nothing to do with anything. So we can't tell whether he decided that it wasn't fraudulent as opposed to it didn't exacerbate the damages, and we can't tell that he decided it didn't happen as opposed to it wasn't intentional. So there's no way to determine that from the determination that the exceptions didn't apply, that there wasn't things going on in that plant with spent catalyst that people were complaining about.
Well, there is no record of any hearing, but the evidence that was before the state court, which was the evidence that was submitted by Mobile, specifically demonstrated that Mobile did not intentionally injure
But Judge Berzon's point, with which I agree, is that evidence and a determination as to the evidence that you're now referring to was not necessary to its decision. And it doesn't explain anything. It just says that none of the exclusions apply. This is covered under workers' comp. That's all you get. And the points that you now seek to establish were not necessary to its decision. I mean, boom, boom. End of argument.
Well, it seems to me that they were necessary to the state court's decision in the first case, because he could not have ruled that we didn't intentionally injure Mr. McDaniels or that we didn't fraudulently conceal the injury from
us. He could have decided, first of all, in the fraudulent concealment, he didn't even have to decide that you didn't fraudulently conceal. He could have just decided that it didn't exacerbate his injury. So on that, you're totally out, because there was no necessary determination with regard to the fraudulent concealment. And as to the, do you have any response to that?
Well, no, that's fine. But as to whether we intentionally injured
him. All right, so you didn't. Let's assume he decided you didn't intentionally injure him. What does that have to do with whether or not there were, in fact, spent catalyst violations going on in the plant and retaliations because of it? They could have been non-intentional spent catalyst violations going on in the plant.
Well,
All he decided was a state of mind, in other words. He didn't decide objective facts. He had no reason to decide objective facts.
Well, it seems to me that in order for him to determine the evidence that came in on whether we intentionally injured Mr. McDaniels went to whether we had run the plant beyond the environmental regulations, whether we had ignored complaints about spent catalyst, whether there was a nosebleed incident, whether that was caused by the
none of which requires proving that you did anything intentionally, as opposed to negligently, recklessly, or otherwise without due care.
All right, I see the point that you're making. In other words, the trial court and the state court action, you're saying, simply determined that the intentional injury component of the exception.
Right, not that the things didn't happen, but they didn't happen intentionally.
Well,
they had to decide.
Well, it seems to me that the evidence that was submitted in support of the summary judgment motion, he didn't necessarily have to decide that, but he... But it was there that there were neither intentional nor negligent noncompliance with
it. And I will add, just in case it becomes relevant, if you decide to advance the collateral estoppel argument below again, intent with respect to workers' comp exclusion may have a different definition of intent with respect to whether or not I intend to allow spent catalyst to build up and so on.
Well,
there are various ways of deciding intent. And intent with respect to the exclusion for workers' comp has a very specific definition.
Well, that's fine. I understand the points that you're making, and it seems to me that the argument, if the court were to remand, it would be that Mr. McDaniels did not complain about these matters, that these were his theories that he developed.
All right, that goes to the 403 issue, which may be.
Which
or the merits.
That's right, but the 403 issue was before Judge Hatter, yeah. And it was fully briefed, and it was... both sides.
And was not actually and necessarily decided by Judge Hatter. Just to repeat the formula of collateral estoppel.
Let me ask you a question. How did that 10 hours work out?
It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic.
I don't understand.
Well, it was a battle to get it in, but
so
I thought it worked.
To say 10 hours didn't happen, then sometimes it is to say in 10 hours that it did.
That's right. I think it was...
You can review the whole history of the Civil War in 10 hours. You know how to present the information. Otherwise, the lawyers go on and on and on and on. And the jury is starting to nod off and take a nap. Of course, that's good for their cardiovascular system. Read the paper.
I heard that. If I could just make one final point, and I will keep it very brief, it relates to the strength of the evidence on the disability discrimination claim. And we devoted a great deal of attention to that in our brief for a reason, because we wanted to put his termination in context. At the conclusion of Mr. McDaniel's leave or light-duty work period while his injury was going from in flux to permanent, his doctor issued a very severe and stringent restriction that said that he could not be exposed to any gases, dust, odors, heat, cold, humidity. And that was the basis of the decision to end his employment.
He
could not have worn a respirator because there was actually testimony from Dr. Scannell that the respirator would not have prevented all exposures, because there were times when you have to lift up in an emergency, you may have to lift your respirator to talk on your walkie-talkie. So we could not guarantee that he would never be exposed to any gases, dust, or odors. We simply couldn't do that. And that was the reason for the decision to end his employment. We could not reasonably accommodate the very stringent requirements that Dr. Weintraub placed on him. And we noted this in our brief, and we said that even that Dr. Weintraub never came back to Mobil and said, I think you've misinterpreted my restrictions. I never meant for this man to not be able to work in the refinery.
Did your people have conversations with Dr. Weintraub?
They did. Dr. Jean had several conversations, and there was testimony at trial on that. He talked to him several times and exchanged correspondence with him. There was a great deal of interaction.
And Dr. Jean said, are you sure that it has to be this strict?
Yes, because Dr. Jean, we excerpted this testimony, he was really impacted by the fact that this man might lose his job because of the strictness of that restriction. And so he gave great consideration to whether that was what Dr. Weintraub really meant by it. Thank you.
Well, with you two squaring up, it'd be a pretty light.
Well, Your Honor, I was feeling originally kind of badly that I normally on an appeal I'm the attorney.
You feel bad, not bad.
Oh, bad. Okay. But I think that Ms. Doty's recollection of what occurred is inexact, and in fact, you stole my thunder on the collateral estoppel. It is clear that every time she made an argument.
I stole your thunder. You got a lot left.
Okay.
I hate to say this, Your Honor, but you reminded my dad. You from New York, too?
I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. He used to say the same thing, cut us short. We had six kids. We had about 5 minutes to complain about anything, and that was it. Next. But as far as the collateral estoppel argument. Well, Your Honor, I'm talking real fast. I could do all those witnesses in 10 hours.
Is that sometimes, as one of my colleagues said in an appellate advocacy seminar recently, the biggest thing one learns is when to keep quiet.
Okay. So I was just going to remind you that you, the word arguments and collateral estoppel. And just one point. Mr. Bodie did, in the middle of an argument, on page 35 of the trial testimony of October 26, he was asked, did he make complaints referring to Mr. McDonald about catalyst dust? I asked him why he was wearing the respirator, and he said that dust was bothering him, so I didn't assume that was a complaint. That was a response to a question. What catalyst dust? Ms. Doty, objection. It's barred by the collateral estoppel motion. Sustained. So the point that he wasn't complaining at the time on the 403 issue, which, of course, the Court didn't rule on anyway, he was talking about that when Mr.
You're saying that that was also excluded on collateral estoppel grounds, so we don't know whether he was complaining at the time.
Exactly. He was stopped from discussing that. But the point that she's trying to make that, oh, he never complained at the time, when Mr. Lear tried to bring that up, he was stopped from talking about it. Mr. McDaniels, same argument, collateral estoppel. He was not allowed to talk about any of his safety complaints concerning the spent catalyst. And also, Your Honor, as far as the issues on the respirator, Dr. Weintraub and everyone that testified, he had additional doctors. The doctor they presented conflicted their own doctor, Dr. Friedman, who talked about, yes, he could have worked with the respirator as long as the respirator was fitted. But the point is, nobody was supposed to be wearing a respirator. In other words, they wanted to put him back in a condition that wasn't safe for anyone. But that's an issue for the jury to decide. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, my father died a couple years ago in the middle of one of my trials, so, yeah. He was a pretty cool guy.
All right. How about Colwell versus Levitt?